The Bible and Modern Science with your host, Dr. Joseph Henson of the Science Faculty of Bob Jones University. Here is Dr. Henson.
Thank you. On our last program, we had started looking at a new group of organisms, namely the annelids, and had made some introductory comments about those organisms. They are a fairly large phylum, about 15,000 species, and probably two-thirds of those are marine. About 5,000 of them would be terrestrial, the earthworms and leeches. I don't recall when we were talking about the mollusks whether I mentioned the number of total number of species or not. I did make the comment, I think, that mollusk, phylum Mollusca, is the second largest phylum. About almost 90,000 species. Interestingly, about 50,000 of those 90,000 are fossil species, and there are about 35,000 living species of mollusks. So the worms are large, much larger than some. We have a few of the what are referred to as 10 major species that will have only a few thousand, 2,000 or 3,000. So it's a fairly large group. The marine organisms, marine annelids, as I just mentioned, make up by far the largest proportion. These include clam worms. These are the nereids that we have talked about, and we'll talk about some of their characteristics in a moment. Some of them are what are known as plumed worms, parchment worms, scale worms, lug worms, and many, many others. To the best of my knowledge, the marine annelids are not usually used as food. I would suspect probably there are places around the ocean where people may eat them. I'm not commenting whether this is good, bad, or indifferent. It's a matter of ignorance on my part. I really don't know of any reason that they might not be eaten. And, of course, they do form a very, very important part of the marine food chain. The annelids, the marine annelids, are critical to many types of other organisms, fish and a number of others as well. But whether people eat them or not, I don't know. I don't know any reason that they could not do so, but I do not know whether that's a normal part of people's food or not. We've mentioned that they are cosmopolitan. That is, there are annelids that are found all over the world. So most people would have some acquaintance with them in one way or another. The polychaetes, poly, of course, is a word that simply means many, and the chaetes are simply a term that indicate the seti, the little bristle-like structures that we mentioned last time that are made of chitin. And in the marine organisms, the polychaetes, they have many seti. They are usually found on the peripodia, and there are many of them, which is the reason for the name. Many seti that are found on the individual peripodia. These are the flat structures, fleshy structures that we talked about, that are found one pair per body segment. And then each peripodium would have many seti, a couple of dozen, perhaps more in some cases. I don't know. I'm certainly not an expert in marine annelids. But this is the reason for the name. The oligocheta, oligo meaning few, means that in that case there would be a few seti. And these, of course, this is the name that is given to the class that contain oligocheta, that contains the earthworms that we'll talk about a little bit. Many of the, I'd say most of the polychaetes are anywhere from 10 to 20 inches long. The ones that we usually dissect in lab of the clam worms are probably a foot long. I have read and am told that there are some of these that may be up to 3 meters. Now, bearing in mind that a meter is roughly the equivalent of a yard, there are marine annelids that are up to 9 feet in length. And I have not seen any of these, but at least that's what the information that I read tells me. one of the distinctions between the polychaetes and all the other, well, the two other classes, the earthworms and the hirudinea, the polychaetes have a well-defined head. The earthworms, of course, do not have, and leeches do not. So this would be one way of telling the difference. They also have, at least in the clam worm, which I am most familiar with, there is a very well-developed jaw that is there. And if you were to look at these things, they would be long, foot long or so. You'd see the head with two tiny little, what looked like claws sticking out of the front end of the head, which would be the jaws. And then each segment would have a pair of the parapodia sticking out on either side. And they are somewhat flattened. They're not round like the earthworms are, but they're not flat like the flatworms are either. Many of the polychaetes, the term, technical term, is urehaline, which simply means that they can tolerate a rather wide range of salt concentration in their water. So they can live in the ocean where you have a fairly high concentration of salt. They could live in an intertidal zone where you have brackish water with varying amounts of salt in it. And some of them can tolerate even in fresh water, or any of those. That's what the term means, which is a little bit unusual. There are areas, particularly where you have areas of exposed mudflats. I spent some time in Korea back toward the end of the Korean War, and those that have any knowledge of that are aware that there are up to 20 miles of mudflats exposed around the South Korean coast. And where you have the mudflats, in a square meter, a square yard of mud, there may be thousands of these polychaetes. In those cases, obviously, they're going to be much smaller. And some of them are not large. They're not inches long. Some of them are perhaps a millimeter in length. And for those of you that are familiar with metric units, this means that you would have some difficulty in seeing them with the naked eye. So the size ranges from a millimeter up to 9 feet. They have unbelievable variation in colors collectively. A single worm doesn't vary in color much, but they can be red or blue or yellow or green, very brightly colored in some cases. Many of them are somewhat neutral colored. There are two major divisions. I don't know that these are taxonomic divisions, but there are those that are referred to as sedentary. This means that they're going to stay pretty much in the same place. And of those, some of them will build themselves tubes and simply stay there. They'll spend their entire life in the tube. The others are errant, which I'm not sure is quite a good name for them. They haven't committed sin of some sort. Or free moving. That is, they are free to move about wherever they want to. So you'd have these two major divisions in the class itself. The polychaetes are generally there are separate sexes. And again, the technical term for this is dioecious. That means there are male and female. Now, it is interesting that there are many of them that do not have any permanent reproductive organs. Much of their life is spent without reproductive organs. And they are considered sexually immature during that period of time and are referred to as atoke, A-T-O-K-E. Then at some time during the course of the year, a certain portion of the body will begin to form reproductive organs. These are usually done in the parapodia. And the gametes then are transferred into the body cavity, the coelom. And we'll talk about one of those rather interestingly in a moment. One of the marine parakeets that are known as Palola worms, P-A-L-O-L-O worms. These are found in coral reefs. They live in burrows there. And during what is referred to as the swarming period, the epitokes, this, in the case of the Palola worm, is simply the posterior part of the body which have developed reproductive glands. these parts will break off and swim to the surface. And then just before sunrise, the sea is literally covered with these partial worm, parts of the worm, the posterior portion of the worm, are simply up on the surface of the ocean. At sunrise, they burst. Their bodies simply split open, and the gametes then are freed into the water and can engage in fertilization. As you can imagine, places where this occur cause a great deal of activity, a furor of activity. Not only do you have the gametes, the egg and sperm, that are fertilizing each other, sperm fertilizing the eggs, but you also have a tremendous opportunity for predators. So all sorts of organisms are drawn to that particular site, and obviously many of the gametes are going to be destroyed as a consequence of that. But many of them, of course, will fertilize and will produce the next generation of these organisms, and they will return, and each of the young ones will then form their own burrows in the coral. Now, all these things that we have talked about, again, there is the problem, if you're an evolutionist, of trying to assess how they could have occurred when the ancestors did not have them. And many of these things are absolutely essential to the life of the organism. If they do not have them, not partially formed, but if they do not have them functioning as they are intended to function, then the organism simply dies. So that the idea that evolution can be sort of a trial and error kind of thing, that you have some unbelievably fortuitous changes in a particular, a few especially lucky organisms that are going to begin to form the head or the parapodia or any of the other things that we've talked about. And there's a trial and error kind of thing that allows the fortunate ones to live and the others to die is simply nonsensical. All the things that we've talked about in the polychaetes are unique in some respects. Some of them are unique, but they are certainly unique if you're an evolutionist. And the notion that they are simply going to be forming as a result of mutation or some other random process simply does not make good sense.
Thank you, Dr. Henson. You may send email to Dr. Henson at jhenson@bju.edu. That's jhenson@bju.edu. Or write to Dr. Joseph L. Henson, Box 34621, Bob Jones University, Greenville, South Carolina, zip code 29614, in the United States of America. You're invited to listen next time for The Bible and Modern Science.